Welcome to the 40th episode of Metico Talks. For this episode, we're focused on real-life examples of digital asset use cases and business models in the banking and the corporate world. For this, we're joined by David Greer, who leads the DLT and crypto practice. Thanks, David. At TFT, a digital transformation pioneer that develops enterprise solutions and is a Metico partner that delivers end-to-end and efficient institutional digital asset custody and tokenization solutions for banks and corporates globally. That's a mouthful. David brings a nearly two-decade experience in corporate innovation teams and has a wealth of firsthand information from DLT and blockchain-related enterprise projects across a number of industry-specific verticals. David, welcome. Great to have you here.
Thanks, James.
So, it'd be great to hear, you know, as usual, your journey, how you got into this space, and also to tell us a bit about GFT for those that aren't familiar with the organization.
Yeah, thanks. You know, really happy to be here, and obviously, really great to be on this talk. So we watched a lot of them, so really good to be speaking.
Excellent.
So how do I get into the DLT and crypto space? So when I joined GFT, which was about 7 years or so ago, I was basically working as a capital markets innovation lead. So I was working around any kind of like innovative projects for financial services, but specifically focused in on capital markets. Out of Spain, where our innovation lab is, out of a lot of the time, kind of, you know, working with the city, working with Germany as well, and also New York as well, right? And I was covering all technologies. So I was covering cloud, I was covering AI, I was covering DLT and crypto. And at that point in time, it just happened to be the kind of almost like blockchain 2.0 smart contract evolution. And there was actually a person who's sitting here in London. I'm actually in the city today, who was just quite inspired by this, by, you know, what smart contracts could do and how they could revolutionize capital markets. And he decided that he wanted to start doing this. And he was basically, you know, using that to be able to get his contacts going and get the first projects that we had. And that was in 2013, 2014. And I was just lucky enough to be in that innovation consultant, technical kind of consultant role at that point in time. Previously, that had been more on the engineering side. And very much involved in the first projects that we had. And then from that, I just got the bug, right? So I just really enjoyed it and saw that there was immense potential in this and very much an untapped area as well. Started working, and at that point in time, probably up until maybe about 2018 or so, pretty much involved in all of the projects at GFT in some way, shape, or form. And now GFT, I mean, we're doing like about 8 or 9 ongoing DLT projects. Of those ongoing 8 or 9, maybe I'm involved in 2 or 3 of them, right? Even at, you know, early stage sales. So we've grown a lot over the years, and very happy to have been part of that journey. And you know, I think part of it's luck, right? And part of it's what you do, how you make that luck. So happy to be in the right place at the right time. And GFT, I suppose more generally, we're a technology services company. So we provide value added services for our clients, but we do a lot of technology consultants. So we're basically doing a lot of like development work, but also we can do like technical architecture. We can do design and delivery. We can do all the maintenance and support afterwards. And we typically work with financial services institutions. So, you know, all of the tier one banks are our clients. We also work with a lot of exchanges, asset managers, so on and so forth. But we also work with quite a few industry players you know, things like automotive as well. I might touch on that a little bit later. We are 10,000 people worldwide, so we're not one of the big four or whatever, but we're definitely you know, quite a significant organization and can scale to be able to deliver for things. And we have a big focus on innovation. So when I started, the GFT was really very much a delivery place with an innovation lab, and I was very lucky to start in that innovation lab. And then in the last 7 or 8 years since I started at GFT, actually innovation has become really one of the core parts of our business. So, you know, our cloud, our AI, our DLT, and our blockchain offerings are something that we actually go to clients with. And that's a big differentiator for us. And, you know, especially some of the more mature areas like data and cloud, for example, which were part of the innovation lab when I joined, they're actually part of the core offering now and a significant part of our revenue. So we think about the future, we think about where technology is going, how that affects our clients, and then we go and build stuff for clients based around that. So that's what we do. That's how I started. And yeah.
Super intro. So I mean, for you as an engineer turned consultant, that was, as you say, in the right place at the right time. Over the last 7-8 years, and it's notable that you've been working with us or our clients for the last, I think, 5+ years. What are the changes you've observed in the space in terms of the shift in focus, utility approach? Because obviously, you have a lot more context than most to comment on that.
Yeah, so I think there's been a big shift in focus from, let's say, experimentation. So it's taken a long time to get out of that experimentation and into thinking about live projects. A lot of our clients now are actually not even bothering to think about experimentation. Like, the experimentation is basically done on a theoretical level, but there's very little POCs going on, especially in the big financial services institutions. What they want to do is they want to get something and build it live and then get the value from it. I think it's been quite good that there's not so much buzz around crypto, to be honest with you. So the crypto winter and also the rise of AI and so on and so forth has meant that people can actually kind of get projects done, and there's less kind of random, oh, let's just go on the blockchain in there, which I always thought was not really a good approach, to be honest with you. The other thing was that was that the people have changed as well. So inside of these big corporations, we found that actually when we started, that we were going in and we were speaking to them around blockchain, DLT, and often it was a case that we were very much more informed than the people that were actually in these big bands. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have big teams, right? So it was maybe like one person, usually in the CIO or the CTO office, that was quite involved in DLT and crypto. And they would be kind of given this thing, but actually they didn't really necessarily have experts. And we kind of came in and we helped them to be able to design and develop their solutions. And actually now, all of the large financial services institutions and a lot of the smaller financial services institutions have really kind of matured in the way they think about it and the way they staff their innovation labs to have specialists. And this is not just in the financial services institution itself, also in the regulators and also in other bodies as well. So, for example, for the BIS, we work with the BIS for quite a long time. A lot of people that are now on the BIS are actually people that came from Circle or came from other, crypto-backed industries, right? And this is a very traditional financial services institution, right? We also see that people are kind of thinking about less about the technology and thinking about more about the problems as well. So we're getting less, often when we go in now, we don't have to explain yet what is blockchain, what are the benefits of blockchain, what is a smart contract, what is a transaction. Now it seems that most people, at least in the technical teams, but also on the business side teams, know this. And now we're talking about, okay, so what is the problem that you're facing? Mm. How can we kind of work around this to be able to work out on specific solutions to that that make sense. So that's quite good, and that makes our life a lot easier, really. And I think that's been a big change.
We've described a long journey, but it does sound, and we've come a long way. But as you said, it sounds like we're still very early in that journey, despite how far we've come. Given that shift you described from technology to use case, or from technology to opportunity. Where do you see the highest level adoption? What are the use cases they're focusing on? Looking across different segments that you cover.
So I would say that we're very early on still. So we're really 1% adoption, maybe not even that. I think we're very early stage. I think we're getting things to production, which is good, but we're not fully adopting the technology. Because the way that I see this technology is that this technology could underpin the internet of the future, potentially. And it could also underpin, for example, interactions in smart cities or your digital passports or whatever it is. And we're a long way away from being at the level of which it's actually underpinning the majority of transactions that we do. So in a kind of, I suppose, maximist way of thinking about it, about how can we actually leverage this technology to be able to really enhance the security of any transactional process. I think that we're not very far along in that journey. I think it depends on which area you're looking at. I think the financial services industries have been the area which is most evolved. That's obviously because of the fact that they want to be able to provide new services to their clients, and they want to be able to also, to a certain extent, future-proof themselves against competition from other types of organizations as well. So if you think about the way that you have the open market in the crypto side, and then you have the financial services in the financial services industry, it's clear that the banks need to also offer the similar kind of services that, you know, a decentralized exchange might offer, for example, right? And they have to protect themselves to be able to do that. So they have been very forward-thinking in the way that they have approached this when you compare them to, I don't know, an industry player or something like that, right? There are some significant things that need to happen if they want to use DLT and smart contracts and blockchain to be able to really completely move away from the current model, though. So a lot of the time when we were going into financial services institutions, we're speaking about, hey, look, you could replace, for example, your ledger, right? And I think this is the ultimate goal a lot of the time when you think about banks is, you know, how do we reimagine the ledger? How could we reimagine how we interact for the settlement process, for example, right? But to be able to do that at a large institution and to be able to change all of the interaction points that has with all the other different systems and convert all of those across to a DLT smart contract based system, that's a huge systematic change, right? And we are at probably the start of that, where bits of it are getting changed, but not the whole thing, because the idea of kind of, you know, taking away all of that and replumbing the whole thing, get into a DLT kind of smart contracts system is probably too difficult. But you do have some interesting advances, especially in the security space, where they have managed to build these kinds of, you know, smart contract enabled exchanges, things like D7, for example, from Deutsche Börse, where they have managed to build these kinds of exchanges and actually use that as a plumbing and have an alternative, which is quicker, more efficient, better, that they can say, well, actually, if we do use this system, then we're going to get these benefits from it. And I think that's really important. Don't take the big picture view, because that will probably never happen. Try and do something that you can use on the side and then show the value from it. And eventually you'll probably move over to the new thing. The other thing is that we have different types of organizations doing different things, right? So the large established banks are very much, you know, on the road to production. They're thinking about global infrastructure. They're thinking about the long-term thing. You know, some of them have, you know, hundreds of people working on these projects, right? And they're doing it across different areas as well. So some of them are working in FX. A lot of them are working in securities, asset management, whatever, you know. But if you compare them to, for example, like challenger banks, some of the challenger banks are thinking about it in a very different way. So they are thinking about, you know, how do we diversify the type of products that we can offer? How do we create something that's maybe a little bit more DeFi, more like a DeFi product, right? And again, that some of the smaller asset managers, and even some of the bigger asset managers and the wealth managers, even the private banks, they are thinking about how to produce different products for the market that maybe, you know, a very large systemic bank might be difficult for them to be able to get something big off the ground like that, because that would be a big change for them, right? I think the other thing that's kind of interesting is that outside of the financial services area, as I said before, we're getting, you know, more traction in just generally, so you know, things like supply chain, automobile, even treasury, you know, like people actually taking Bitcoin or Ether and being able to make payments through that, and taking Bitcoin and Ether onto their books. I don't think we're quite there yet with that. I think that we've got a few very brave companies that are going out and doing that. But I don't think we're a million miles away from that being a reality. And I think that it's completely possible because it's really just an accounting change. It's an accounting and technology change. And it's a change of shift in the way that people are thinking about things. It's from an integration point of view and from a migration point of view, it's not that big a change to be able to say, hey, look, we also support payment, for example, in crypto. So I think those are the things that I'm kind of like seeing. And I think we're probably going to see a lot of new product coming to market and probably things that we haven't even thought about, to be honest with you. And that's the beauty of smart contracts, is that you can think about different models and different ways of working and different products, right? And I'm sure we're going to see more of that.
No doubt, that's true. I mean, kind of going back to your comment about how we're still early. I mean, let's stick to banks for a second. I mean, you mentioned basically the larger banks or basically the initiatives like D7 and issues. What sounds like a simple problem is resolving ledgers in the organization and focus on ledgers. But it sounds simple. It sounds obvious. The objective is great. You simplify a single source of truth. But I was speaking to one large universe bank last week, and just a single division in a security services division, they had 75 different ledgers. So I think to me, the question is always, and I think it'd be interesting to talk a little bit, you know, given your stance of different types of banks, how do you get started? I mean, that sounds like a simple objective, but it sounds like a Herculean task when you've got 75 ledgers and you try to have one ledger to rule them all, basically, or that's not the case. But how do you start? And, you know, what are the milestones dependencies to actually go to market to commercialize this stuff? Or is that even what commercializing, or is it just about cost reduction?
Yeah, so I think that's a really good question. And it's a real challenge for these banks, not just in the DLT and crypto space, but just in general, right? To be able to manage all of the systems that they have and make sure that all of these systems are connected and that any new thing that you're trying to introduce does not have a negative impact on all of the systems that are already running, right?
You can't break what you have, right?
You can't break what you have, that's right. You still got to carry on with the day-to-day business. You know, some of these, you know, so you're talking about the, you know, 75 ledgers, but actually you have maybe 300 systems. And some of these are external systems as well. And that complexity, you will never get rid of 100%. But I would almost twist this round sometimes, because when you think about it, the 300 systems that you have to, you know, maintain and keep, then you have to reconcile all the data across all of these systems. And reconciling the data across 70 ledgers or 70 different data sets is very difficult, because you have to, you know, wait until the end of day. You've got to bring all the information. You've got to understand where your data is coming from. Understand where the position is at, and who has let's say the responsibility in the operations role. To be able to basically deal with any issue if there is any issue. And these reconciliation processes take, you know, hours, right? They take hours to be able to do, because a lot of the time we're talking about legacy software that is not quick to be able to do reconciliation. And that's become better because of technology, right? So a lot of the time now, they're kind of extracting data from legacy, putting it onto new systems, and then they're doing the reconciliation. They still have to extract that data. There's no way around that. They have to get it somehow. So it takes time. And that is time that can't be used for trading. And therefore, we're losing money because, you know, we can't do 24-hour trading like you can with crypto. I would say that, yes, it's a big challenge. And yes, you have to really plan to be able to deploy into production and change the way that you're working, especially for a settlement system, to move over to smart contracts. But the benefits are that you will have something which is more more secure, and you'll have the golden source of truth that all of the other systems can use. So that actually, at the end of the day, the reconciliation process won't potentially even be necessary. I mean, it might be necessary in some places, but not across the board, because you should know that as a consumer of the ledger of the DLT that actually this is where the position is at when you're making the trade. And that's really important. I think the other thing is about risk, right? So when you're talking about bringing any of these things to production, you have to think about risk. Risk is really important. This is something that when when working in the innovation lab, a lot of people don't really think about how, you know, the risk of working with a particular technology, making a new product, bring a new project to life, how the effect of using a new type of currency would have on the original business, for example, and what this means in terms of the financial risk as well. So not even just the technical reputational risk of the bank, but also the financial risk of maybe using some of these cryptos, for example. And I think that the interesting thing is there's really good risk people now that are actually working with these large institutions, and they are taking it upon themselves to make bulletproof de-risked solutions, so that when they do go live, when they do go to production, there's no kind of, you know, complications and issues with them that maybe there would be if you didn't have actual risk specialists in the crypto area. And that's something that's quite new, actually. That's something that I think we'd be kind of seeing. You always had risk people involved, but they weren't crypto risk people. And actually now there's quite a few crypto risk people who are really good. So that, I think the large banks are looking at that. I think that a lot of challenger banks and the asset managers and all of these kinds of guys are, for them, it's a little bit easier because they have a ledger. They might have, you know, a handful of the systems, you know, maybe 20 systems, something like that, that they link into, but it's a lot easier for them to be able to get something on the ground. And therefore they can move a lot quicker as well, right? So I think we're seeing a lot more interesting new types of tokenization coming from these challenger banks, new types of products, all of that kind of stuff. And also from the small private wealth banks as well, right? I mean, even if they're spin-offs of some of the bigger banks, they can just move a lot more quickly. And they have an appetite from their clients to be doing new things in this area as well, right? And giving new products and adding more to their portfolio soon. So yeah, I think we're seeing more movement from the private wealth, asset managers, and challenger crypto banks. But the big banks will do it, but it just is more complicated.
But I think the key theme you touched on is, and I think this goes back to how we have, although it's still early, we've matured a lot, is that this asset class and this technology is not going away. And it can no longer be treated as an experiment outside the norms that the bank has to comply with otherwise. And now it has to be fully integrated. And as you said, while the risk and control processes, there's no exception because it's shiny and new. Basically, it needs to have the same rigorous compliance that you would expect across the rest of the bank, which is good. But, you know, some friction, I suppose, for those that want to move fast and break things. But that's like just the nature of the beast in financial markets.
Yeah.
If we touch a little bit, kind of, you've talked about, you know, the, I guess the stages of adoption, different segments. It might be fun just to put some numbers on these, just to make it more concrete. If we looked at basically, you know, the different stages of DLT, digital asset, in terms of percentages by segment, where do you think the most mature, if we look at live commercial offering and production, prototyping, you say, but nobody wants to do POCs anymore, but we see a little bit of it still, business case creation, or, you know, still, you know, interested, but not doing anything, or not interested at all. So if we look at, let's say, live commercial offering and production, what percentage do we look across financial markets, banks in specific? Where do you think, what percentage do you think are live? Yeah.
I think live production and probably about 30% or something like that. I don't think we're much more than that. I think banks were planning to do much more, and I think regulation is allowing them to maybe do much more in the future. This year and next year will be a big change, actually, for what's going on. You know, so we've seen a lot more movement in the large financial services institutions. So I think at this point in time, it's probably about 30% there. I think in the POC,
that's pretty positive. Yeah,
it is, though, because I've seen people that have been working since 2014, 2015 on bringing things to production, and those have come to fruition. Right. So that's not everything, but that is quite a lot of projects. And I don't think people quite appreciate that. I think that people still think that we're in the experimentation phase, whereas actually we're not. Then prototyping and POC, I think there's a lot going on. So I think this is maybe another, yeah, I don't know, 30%, maybe a bit more, not 40%. But a lot of that is building up to things which are going into production next year. or the year after. So I think we are still, maybe I should eat my words a little bit again. I think we are still prototyping and we are still building POCs, but they're not POCs. They're not exactly POCs. They're more
prototypes. For the sake of POCs, right?
Yeah, exactly. We're not experimenting anymore. Yeah. We're actually building MVPs or prototypes to be able to evaluate it from a business point of view, not to see whether it's possible, because actually we all know that a token is possible. We all know that we have a secondary market the public blockchain networks. We all know that we can do DeFi products, and we all know how they work, right? So it's not, none of this is unknown anymore. And a lot of the time, we work with, other innovation companies, and, often they come in and say, hey, look, let's do something on an innovation budget. And my thing is like, well, actually, is this really innovation? Because most of the time, we're just doing something which has already been done in previous areas. And there are some things like, I don't know, ZK rollups, or maybe stuff with the metaverse, or maybe things around different ways that you could be dealing with your keys, for example, which are very innovative and futuristic. But the actual use cases which you use on top of them are often not innovation in its own. They're not research and development in the way that they were maybe 5 years ago. So I think that we're prototyping and we're building POCs, but most of that is going to production. And then business case creation, and I would say that most banks are doing this. I don't think there's any banks that are really not interested at all. Every bank is doing a bit of dabbling, right? Like, what would we do if? How do we do this? And most banks are kind of, taking it to the next level of looking at the different stages of what would it look like if we did do this as well, from a kind of, from an investment, project planning, just purely operational and functional perspective as well. So yeah, I would say that there's probably, another good 40% of banks that are just kind of, whiteboarding it, right? Trying to figure out, what is our plan and our strategy for this? What are the next movers? But it depends on the market. So it depends on the regulators, as on the market. So in Germany, we're a German company, right? Yep. That's all of the German banks practically are now moving forward with this, and have been for the past year or so, because the regulators made it very clear that they were going to be giving out crypto licenses, and therefore they can go and get licenses to be able to run their crypto banks, without kind of going into the details of what you had to do to be able to do that. That gives them the green light to be able to do this, and therefore they can start to work in public networks. They can start to have crypto banks for their clients. But if you compare that to some other countries, they just don't have that clarity right from the regulator. And there's a lot of countries that are in between. I would say that the majority of countries are in between. So when we get more clarity from the regulator and we get more regulations that are in place, like MiCA will be in place next year, which has been a good, good thing for Europe, for all the European countries. But if you can do more clear regulation and put that into place, then most of the banks are going to do prototyping and projects in the end. It's more about clarity of regulation than a kind of tech worry, I would say.
That's great to hear, because I think it's funny, because I think in 2018, with some of the projects we were jointly involved with, they were implementing Harmonize. They implemented our solution, which was not called Harmonize at the time, but it's now called Harmonize. They're really pioneers. To the degree they were taking some career risk in this space, whereas now when you've described, particularly in places like Germany or where those markets where there's clear regulation or regulation coming, it's career risk not being involved in the space, basically, right? Because it's no longer on the fringe. It's basically front and center for many reasons. We've talked a lot about banks, but you also alluded earlier to the non-financials, and what they're doing. And, I keep thinking, particularly in the context of the U.S., there's been a lot of concerns about, the lack of regulation. And other markets, it's evolving quicker, let's say. But across the board, if for non-financials get involved, it's potentially an opportunity because they're not encumbered by the same same regulatory constraints that a bank might be. What sort of activity are you seeing there? And is that a fair assumption that the unregulated space potentially can move quicker and seize opportunities in the space? The banks might not, but might need to take a lot much longer horizon.
Yeah. I mean, this is almost another talk, right? In its own right.
Of course.
But I think, so it depends on the industry. So for example, pharma, there's lots of regulation. There's lots of regulation around the processes in which you make the pharmaceuticals, around the ways in which the pharmaceuticals are handled, around all of the processes and how you get access to it, all of these kinds of things. So pharma, I think, is highly regulated. But then you have other things like manufacturing. We do have regulation, but the regulation isn't quite as full on, right? So I think trying to put them all into one area is kind of difficult. But you're definitely right about the fact that certain industries like manufacturing probably a little bit less regulated and therefore can move a little bit more quickly. I would say that certainly what we're seeing is we're seeing quite a lot of stuff around retail, pharma, and probably automobile. I think those are also the areas where we're seeing in general more focus on the use of technology, really trying to kind of push technology in general to be able to get better efficiencies, get new things out to their clients, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that we will probably see that we'll have more of that in the future. So I think that we're going to see more things that will affect the end users. So, not just people who are using banks or financial, traders or whatever, but actually, Joe Blogs or, you, me, whoever, driving a car wants to be able to pay for our parking. Maybe that car will have a wallet associated with it that will be able to pay for the parking automatically, or maybe even entrances to, buildings or paying for the metro, or whatever it is. Eventually, these things will come and we'll have, different kinds of, a digital asset potentially to be able to underpin these transactions, right? Interestingly, I think, some of the car manufacturers that are seeing this, so people like, for example, Togg, I think, you're working with them. You've also been involved. I think they're seeing that this is really the future. And I think we're seeing also that, some of the other, distribution companies as well are also seeing this. We're even seeing a little bit of a kind of, mixed match between distribution companies that are working with car manufacturers to be able to say, okay, I want to be able to, for example, give you access to my car to be able to put something in the boot. I think it was Porsche and maybe it was DHL or something like that that were doing that. So we're seeing a lot. I think it's got a lot of potential. I don't think we're quite there yet. I think we've got a bit of a challenge in some of the digitalization of some of these things, because, for example, some of the more manufacturing supply chain type things, they are actually still using paperwork, and we're not even in a digital world.
Yeah.
You then take three steps forward and move into a blockchain smart contracts. Well, that's a bit of a challenge. But in the places where we already have a digital foundation, then I don't see why not to be able to take them to that next level and be able to, provide some more, transactional security by using blockchain, or even, make things, bring new items to market. The metaverse, for example, is a big area for some of these types of clients, retail clients, industry clients as well. So I think we're going to see more in these areas in the future.
I mean, you mentioned Togg. I'm not sure everyone's familiar with it, but it'd be great to, I mean, that was one of the most exciting deals in the last year, given most people think of us as an infrastructure for banks, but now we've got this other application in the corporate space. You want to dive a little bit into who they are, what they're doing, and why, and how and why? As much as you're allowed to, basically speak to it.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah, I mean, so Togg is a Turkish electric vehicle manufacturer and a mobility ecosystem provider. So they're not one or the other; they're kind of the two things. And they're on the high end luxury side of vehicles. very well perceived inside Turkey and also in the automobile industry in general, being quite revolutionary in the way that they're thinking about the vehicle and also how it links into other ecosystems, right? So everything that they're doing inside the vehicle itself is quite different. They've got very good people who are working in their teams, and they're using a lot of other technologies, AI and cloud and data analysts and all of that kind of stuff. And one of the interesting things about Turkey also is that as a country, they're very switched on to crypto and DLT. Now, there's a lot of, I think, out of you know, Europe, I think that they have the largest amount of retail investors in crypto in the whole of Europe, because obviously it's a big country, but there's a lot of people that are, you know, private investors out in DLT. So a lot of the general public are actually quite interested in the idea of working with blockchain. They understand the technology. And there's a little bit of a different perception of it, I would say, to other bits of Europe, where maybe people aren't quite, you know, the day-to-day person on the street doesn't necessarily have a wallet or anything like that, right? And the way that Tog sees things is it's about the mobility ecosystem. So they have a car, and the car is part of that mobility ecosystem, but they want to be able to provide a mobility ecosystem that they can use to be able to connect all of the different moving parts inside Turkey when people are traveling around. And DLT is going to be underpinning part of that. And for example, we are working with them on NFT marketplace, which will be used to be able to have NFTs, which will have value, for example, inside the vehicle, so you can use it in a heads-up display or for other different purposes. And I can't go into the details of this, but also the way that they work with different companies and how they, you know, find efficiencies through tokenization, through the processes that they are doing, and using tokenization to be able to do that. And again, I can't go into too much detail about exactly what they're doing, but the idea is to utilize DLT to be able to automate as much as possible and have security in those in that automation space, and this in a similar way to what you were doing capital markets, but actually using this for flows which are for automobile manufacturing or for mobility ecosystem usage, right?
I mean, I think that's made a lot of interesting points. And I think as corporates get past NFTs became very sexy, and it was kind of like one and done, let's move on. When you've described integrating this into core processes and why security matters. And I think that's obviously a very key takeaway as the corporate sector matures as well. One of the things we see, basically, I think it goes back to the maturity of what you're seeing, is the DLT or the business units that want to embrace this technology still need to make the case, let's say, upward to management. And I think some of your experience, I think it'd be great to get your perspective on when they make that case, what are the pitfalls to avoid? What are the critical areas where not to underinvest? How should they think about prioritization? How to balance the need for testing versus the fast go-to-market you described? And who are those that typically look into, let's say, the key detractor of the organizations that they may be in, and how to face off with them, how to deal with them?
Sorry,
that's a lot of questions, a lot of steps in there.
No, there is quite a few steps. I would say that it's really important that you understand your market. So you understand where your market is and what you can do in terms of regulation and what is feasibly possible. Right. So for example, you might not be able to make payments via crypto. That might not be possible. So you wouldn't build a whole team of people who are payment specialists who are looking to build out a POC around payments, for example. And that would be very clear to you. So I think the first thing is, what's possible based on your business and the regulatory landscape and the legal side of things, and then focus on the things that you can do. Focus on the things that you can do and the things that bring the most value. There is no point in doing something if you're not bringing value to your clients and you're not bringing value to you as a business. I mean, it's very nice to have, I don't know, your shop on the metaverse, but actually if people are not going to be going to that shop or being able to buy an NFT from that shop or whatever it is, then that's a lot of time that you spend building a shop that isn't necessarily actually giving you any value, other than saying, yes, you've got something there, right?
There, yeah.
So it's about understanding your return on investment And then I would say that the faster you can go to market in a secure way, so understanding security risks, understanding the risk that we spoke about before, using good technology like Mataco, using providers who understand how to use that technology, the quicker you can get to market, the better, really, doing so in a secure way. And in terms of the detractors inside the institutions, I think there's always, I think, you know, we always have like, previously we always had things around with, you know, data, for example, all the stuff around, you know, how do you deal with like people's data, all that kind of stuff. I think that was always a challenge at one point in time. So, but I think we're way beyond that now. Most people understand that, yeah, GDPR is a thing. You don't put personal data on the blockchain, and there you go. I think that risk was also a thing that was stopping things as well. And that's why it's really good that we've got proper risk specialists working with the financial services institutes, and also probably with other organizations as well, because that was often the thing that was slowing things down. I think also it's about having the view of what the market is doing as well, right? If you want to be a fast mover, then you've got to have an understanding of what's going on, and there needs to be collaboration, right, between you and other people in a consortium, and that often is somehow a little bit difficult to be able to get off the ground, because not only do you need to get the technical people speaking to each other, but you also need to get the business people speaking to each other, and also usually the upper management speaking to each other and saying, yes, this is a good thing to do, and we need to collaborate. And financial services institutions are quite good at that, actually, surprisingly. But there is sometimes a little bit of resistance there to be kind of getting together and working on things, or it just takes a little bit of time to do. It's not resistance as such, but it has to make sense. There's got to be a return on investment. If there's not going to be a return on investment in a significant period of time, then building a consortium and working in that kind of consortium is a significant challenge, or something that maybe isn't giving you that much value. So I think it's, what is the value of what you're doing? Does it make sense to do that based on the investment that you're going to be doing? And if you have that and you can figure that out, then just try and go to market as quickly as possible.
Great point.
Because you're probably not the only person that's also thinking that.
Exactly. Exactly. If you're thinking about it, other people are moving on. It's usually true. But I mean, we're getting close to time, so maybe just wrap up with a couple. We covered a lot of ground. Thank you for that. And just wrap up with a couple couple of short questions. You know, often basically the best way to demonstrate value is show me doing something yourself, so you can show the clients why. Is GFT leveraging DLT itself and digital assets itself for itself?
Yeah. So we've got a couple of things that we're doing ourselves. So we have the Universal Digital Payments Network, the UDPN. So this is like a payments network for stable coins and for CBDCs in the future. So that's something that we've been building for the last three and a half years or so. And we're working on that with a number of banks now as part of the consortium, but we very much built that. We were one of the first people to start building on that and doing a lot of interesting POCs there. So that was definitely something that we brought to market. The other thing that we are doing is to be able to help our banking clients accelerate their integration with core banking services. We are integrating into a lot of different core banking services and basically using them as accelerators. So for example, with Thought Machine, we have built up an accelerator called Banklight X, which basically creates the kind of almost like a bank in a box, but does all of the infrastructure side of things on top of Google Cloud, and provides the interface as well to Thought Machine. And on top of that, we've also basically been integrating Mataco as well. So to be able to have a kind of crypto bank out of a box that can be used either by people that are using Thought Machine or to people that are building up new challenger banks and want to be able to do so with a very cutting edge core banking service as well, right? So these are the kinds, and we're doing similar things with other technology providers. So we are doing that. We do have we're not exactly a product house, We do have, let's say, accelerators and a few products and quite a few initiatives like that. Another thing worth mentioning is we do a thing. We bought or we're merging, shall I say, with a company called Tardigans in Germany, and they have a product called DLT to Pain, and that's like a connection link between DLT networks at Ethereum, for example, and a payment networks like Swift as well. So that's probably something worth mentioning as well.
A lot going on. That sounds very exciting. Clearly, the good news sounds like DLT / blockchain crypto is becoming a more relevant part of your practice on a global basis. It's no longer good to hear. Anything we can expect from you guys next? Where will you be speaking? Where can people meet you? How can they reach out?
So I think I'll be at a lot of the conferences, I would imagine, over the next few months. So we're not quite sure exactly which ones at this point in time, but probably a few of the bigger ones. And then we also will be having some events directly with Mataco in Germany later this year as well. So if you're based in Germany and you would like to join them, then please do. It'd be great to see any of the people that are here and on that event as well.
Right. Thanks, David. Well, I think we're going to wrap up there. It's been great to have you. We've covered a lot of ground. Thank you for the insights. It's always great to listen to people who are, deep in this space with real world projects as opposed to just hypothesizing about potential. So thank you for giving us a very optimistic look on the way forward as well. And thanks for being here.
Perfect. Oh, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
Thanks, David.
Yeah, thank you.
Likewise. Thanks, David. Thanks for everyone for tuning in. And we'll announce when the recording and transcript on the conversation will be available on Mataco.com, as usual. And in the meantime, please follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter and let us know your feedback in the comments. Thanks again. See you soon. Enjoy the summer.